I'm very pleased to introduce our final speaker for the evening, Representative John Conyers. He was first elected to Congress in 1964, and currently Representative Conyers is the second most senior member of the House of Representatives. And he was elected by his congressional colleagues to lead the Democratic side of the pivotal House Committee on the Judiciary. He is also one of the 13 founding members of the Congressional Black Caucus. In Mr. Conyers' tenure in Congress, some of his major accomplishments have included the Violence Against Women's Act of 1994, the Motor Voter Bill of 1993, the Martin Luther King Holiday Act of 83, and he was one of the driving forces behind the Help America Vote Act of 2002. In his role in the Judiciary Committee, Representative Conyers has introduced and endorsed legislation to advance civil liberties, ensure equal protection and access to the voting booth, and to combat violence against women. Since September 11th, he has worked to strike a balance between keeping our country safe from terrorism and protecting civil liberties of our citizens. During the 107th Congress, Conyers introduced the Military Tribunal Authorization Act of 2002, which provides lawmakers with an opportunity to exercise their constitutional authority to define and regulate the use of military tribunals. Today's event will be Representative Conyers' first public speech on the issue of torture by American forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. Please help me welcome our distinguished guest, the Representative John Conyers.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Lana. Thanks, Tiffany. To Rosalind Wright, the moving force behind this. And what a privilege to be with Mark Danner and a woman lawyer who shows all lawyers what good lawyering ought to be like, Barbara Olshansky. We're happy to be with all of you tonight. I brought along a lawyer too, Michelle Richardson, who is on the Judiciary Committee, and she has helped me put together a tremendous speech, which unfortunately will not be delivered tonight. But we have a great number of opportunities to use it. Instead, I've made some notes that will hopefully complement the great comments that have already been made. You see, today our nation stands on the verge of a civil liberties calamity. It's focused here tonight by Amnesty International and the university chapter in a very remarkable way, but that is the vehicle in which we are going to bring millions of people into this, the visuals, the day-to-day struggles, checking out the Center for Constitutional Rights web page where she and Ron Daniels and many others are up there working, setting the pace, and the American Civil Liberties Union is in on this too. There are more and more citizens becoming aware that this torture, this rendition, this ghastly idea of us having a plane that takes people to countries where there is torture being practiced, who are on the terrorist list, and submitting them to these countries is obnoxious, and we're going to do something about it. We've got to do something about it. We have to ask ourselves, parenthetically, is this torture really new or has it been going on all the time? And I'm thinking about some of the practices that go on in our American prisons and jails. No, we don't. I don't think we line up naked bodies in piles, but I do think that there are some practices going on in American prisons that could not stand the kind of inspection that Oshansky and her lawyers would bring to this subject matter. And so what we're doing here is talking about remedies. I was stunned when Mark Danner left the stage with the poignant question, well, what do we do about it? And goodness knows he's documented this more than any other person that I know, chapter and verse, personal testimony. He's made it real, and he continues to make it real. But he is not your average reporter or journalist, because the average reporter or journalist doesn't even wait to be censored by their editor. They know what their editor doesn't want, and so they don't write it in advance. They don't even have to be told what to do. They know what to do already. And it's an incredible day when the Washington Post, which used to really bring forth the headlines, is now outpaced by the New York Times, which isn't even in the Capitol, that can put more penetrating editorials and op-eds out than the major newspaper that served so long in our nation's capital. So, what do we do about it? Well, the first thing we do about it is get as many members to join with me on a bill that Ed Markey and myself and more than a dozen others have put out that deals with an effort to end extraordinary rendition. In other words, we're going to stop that secret plane from sending people to another country where they are sure to be received, and an American plane comes into a terrorist nation. They're leaving them with somebody that they would like very much to get their hands on. We're going to stop that. And this legislation has to be overcome. We call it the Markey proposal. We've got to overcome the conservatives in the Congress, who are largely Republican, of Republican persuasion, to make sure that happens. And then we have to take a larger look at this question, because it would be nice if we could just stay on torture and rendition. There's only one side to that if you have any element of humanity whatsoever. So it's not like a huge debate of what you want to do. Most people would join with us instantly, but we've got to put the movement behind us. It's us that have got to bring it together. But the larger question are the other things that are going on in connection with this. If this were an isolated instance of the administration going wild, it would be great. We would focus on it, we'd get it corrected, and everything would be okay. Well, it's a little bit deeper than that, isn't it? Because we now are having a constitutional crisis in which the separation of powers doctrine, where everybody does what they're supposed to do and stay out of everybody else's business, between the administration, the courts, and the legislature. And this is precisely what is being sadly misconstrued and beaten up, as we can see in case after case and instance after instance, in which the legislature, in a blind rage, strikes out against the federal court. And incidentally, it's a conservative federal court that they're striking out against, to limit class action suits, to put caps on damages, to take one case, the Schiavo case, and say, well, yes, you've been through all the courts and some of the federal courts too. Now we're going to take this case, one case, and we're going to tell you that we're going to start it all over again. They didn't get very far. The court still said, no, you're not. But they tried. And so we know that the separation of powers doctrine is under attack. The whole concept of John Marshall's Marbury versus Madison case, in which the court laid down right from the beginning the dictum that the laws are what we interpret them to be. That's what the courts are for, to tell the legislature and the executive what the laws are. And Marbury versus Madison is now under attack. The courts themselves, the judges are under attack. Who could have imagined that a United States senator would explain how judges can get assassinated because they infuriate people with their doctrinaire decisions? This is stunning, in which we have people from the legislature rationalizing the murder of judges. We have the Bill of Rights under attack, free speech. We have a chilling of free speech in which we have so many things going on here. It's getting the whole elections. The last election was based on intimidating people into believing that if you changed presidents in the middle of a war on terror, that things would get lost. Against a person who has served valiantly in combat, a chest full of medals, they said, oh no, we don't buy that. We're nervous. There are threats coming. Well, where are the threats? Well, we can't tell you, but please be on your alert. I always wondered what people do when they hear that there is a terror alarm and we go from one color to the other. What do? You look at cars going by or people walking past you, or you approach your desk in the morning when you go to work with more scrutiny than normal. How does one handle all of these alerts? We just got the wonderful news that the British Airways is now going to dispense with plastic when they're serving on planes, and they're going back to regular old knives and forks and spoons. I mean, this is a huge breakthrough, and we'll wait to see what our brave U.S. Airlines do when their chance comes up. So here we are, people a little bit afraid of what they can do now. Are we unpatriotic if we dare dissent? If we criticize the commander-in-chief, is that aiding the enemy? If we don't agree with the policies, is this weakening our war against terror? This is the huge propagandistic campaign attack that is subtle and overt, both going on, is amazing to behold. And it's going to take people like ourselves, not just on campuses, but across the country, to begin to remember that this is beginning to look like something that happened in Europe in the 30s. This is dangerous times that we're living in. And the fact that there are a small but courageous number of people to step up to this is very important indeed. We just listened to the instance of Brandon Mayfield in Portland, Oregon, who under the Patriot Act, an American citizen, who they broke into his house, they went through his belongings, they tapped his phone, they even took DNA, all to no avail. There was nothing to be found. But the Patriot Act professes to allow that, to go into a library records, a video store accounts, medical records. We think that this is going too far. And what does it get to? It gets down to the basic premise that we are giving up some of our constitutional rights to fight terror, which is making us more like the enemy rather than making us different from the enemy. This is going on within our country. And it's not being inspired by the enemy. It's coming from our own government. The president has assumed more powers than any of the 43 presidents in the history of the United States of America, starting with the notion of his right to commit a preemptive strike anywhere he wants in the country, in the world. This idea has no basis in law. It cannot be supported or defended anywhere. And to point to a congressional resolution in which we gave the president Article 1, Section 8, which states that only the WHO can declare war. The Congress, that was very carefully put in it right at the beginning of the Constitution, only the Congress can declare war. And it's not a delegable power. We can't say, well, we'll give it to you in the front row here, or we don't want to deal with this, it's too hot. We'll give it to the President of the United States. We are the only ones. If we don't want war, we don't vote war. And there can be no war. We cannot say, well, we're not sure, Mr. President, we'll give it to you, and you take it from there. I maintain that this is blatantly unconstitutional and should never, ever be accepted for even a moment. What we find is that the combination of other compromises in the Patriot Act make it a perfectly scary document. And to make it worse, they're talking about Patriot Act 2. Heaven knows what else is left to take away from us, but we have to make it clear and gather people around it. And the horrors of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and in Afghanistan and Iraq give us this opportunity to fight back. I also wanted to take a brief look at what's gone on before. Grenada, Panama, Rwanda, the coup in Haiti, all instances of applications of force in foreign policy in which we weren't fighting any enemy. There was nobody getting ready to invade or commit war against America. Certainly, as we found out, Iraq wasn't. They'd already been taken out from the Gulf War of 90 and 91. And so what we're looking at in these places, in Africa, in the Sudan, around the nuclear arms race, is that we are gradually losing the constitutional democracy in real time that we have enjoyed for centuries, and it is now being eviscerated. And ironically, as Attorney Olshansky has pointed out in other writings, even the courts that they are taking powers away from, the courts are taking powers away from us at the same time. It's not like these are real good guys on the court, all of them. They've been diminishing civil rights in a terrible way. So what, Mark Danner, do we do about it? Well, we look to our history. The civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King is the one man in my life that I have examined his philosophy of nonviolent movement, the struggle that he created, has been the example to show me what people organized can do. And it starts with a very small number. King did not start with millions of people marching with him. He started with a small group of dedicated people. John Lewis was one of them, now a member of Congress. Young from Georgia was once a member of Congress. Julian Bond, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was down there with them. And I was privileged to join them from time to time and develop this relationship that led me to be so impressed with him. But the civil rights movement gives us a key. The women's rights movement gives us a clue. The anti-Vietnam War movement is one of the great examples in recent history in which people stopped the war. The government didn't stop the war, it was the people. Young people, plenty of them, supported by their parents and another generation before them, that were saying, this madness has got to stop. Jefferson once said that a little revolution every now and then is pretty healthy for a country. We now live in a state that is more like a police state than he could have ever imagined. You're not going to have a little revolution in this country. Those days can't happen. But those of you who represent different organizations on and off the campus, I've met some of you tonight, we can make a difference. Senator Joe Lieberman is going to get the surprise of his life when he comes to Yale University on Monday. I only wish I could be here to be in the audience with you. I have two good friends in the Congress here, Rosa DeLauro and John Larson, and we want to bring them. I hope we can get them on the campus before long. And there is another ray of hope for me, and that is we've got Howard Dean, the new chairman of the Democratic Party, who, it was really amazing. He scared so many people in Washington and in the Democratic National Committee, but many people who may not have supported him for president thought that anybody that is as committed and is ready to fight back against these crypto-fascist activities that are going on, is ready, and they are willing to support Howard Dean, and he easily won. All his opposition eviscerated, and we now have a great chairman. So I close with this note, my brothers and sisters. There's one thing that keeps me going. There are way more of us than they are of them. They may have more money, but we've got more people. But the people, unless they're organized, unless they're voting, and unless they have some clear picture of what they're voting about, doesn't mean anything. And that's what our job is. We can't, everybody won't become political activists, but just to understand, there are so many reasons to be furious with this administration. We could spend 20 minutes just naming the subject matter. But you only need one to say, that's it for you, buddy. And so there are too many issues out there. But this one, the torture and rendition issue, and the Markey Conyers attempt to stop it in its tracks, is something that's going to gather traction, as Mr. Danner said, because we've got the photos, the footage, we've got the testimony. This can't be denied. It's almost undeniable. And so this is the way I think we're going to win. We're going to win through a reinvigorated political process that will lead us to a representative democracy where the people you pick to govern and legislate will be the people that are responding to you. Thank you very much.
Could we show up with the question?